it's especially acute for freelancers who then get really nervous when they're kind of asking to be compensated. All they're asking for is to be compensated fairly.
But I think the rates have been the same for, I don't know how long, but at least 10 years, or if not longer.
When it's sunny, either working from a terrace somewhere, which is the loveliest thing you can do.
Welcome to Media Voices Freelance Special. I'm Chris Sutcliffe. This week, we're going to be looking at the realities of freelance journalism in 2020. And as you'll have heard from those interview snippets, it's going to be as much a celebration of the upsides of freelancing as it is an examination of its pitfalls. You're going to be hearing from journalists and academics about everything from remuneration and payment to gaining skills to mental health, in order to provide as comprehensive an understanding as we possibly can. So it's no exaggeration to say that the newspaper industry in the UK relies on freelancers. In November last year, the NUJ's General Secretary, Michelle Stanistreet, reiterated that the proportion of freelancers in our industry is greater than at any time on record. And according to data from the Office of National Statistics, the number of self-employed journalists in the UK rose sharply from 18,000 in 2015 to 34,000 in 2016. The National Council for the Training of Journalists also put out a report right at the end of 2016, in which the author Mark Spilsbury noted that the proportion of journalists who categorise themselves as being freelance increased from 25 to 35%. Given everything that has happened in the industry over the last couple of years, it is extremely likely that those trends have continued. As a result, the journalism industry has one of the highest proportions of freelance workers to full-time staffers of any sector. There are many, many positive reasons journalists choose to go freelance, and you're going to hear some of them this episode. However, one of the reasons for that increase is the sheer scale of redundancies made by the journalism industry over the past few years, and the number of permanent roles that have been created failing to compensate for that. So if you work in the media or have ever even dipped into Media Voices, you'll know that barely a week goes by without us having to report on more job losses. The NCTJ report states that 42% of respondents to a question on negative reasons for going freelance said that there were no permanent jobs available, and a further 5% attributed it to redundancy specifically. Anna Codriorado is the founder of FJ & Co., a platform for freelance journalists which gives them the tools, resources, and community support they need to make a sustainable self-employed living. Her own path to freelancing was as the result of redundancy, but she does note that she knew at least one thing about freelance journalism going in.
I started freelancing as a result of redundancy, but I was already thinking about doing it anyway. So I did go into freelancing with my eyes fairly open that it would be challenging, particularly on the pay side of things. Mainly getting paid fairly and on time. And particularly in journalism, where there's this quirk around payment on publication. Obviously, journalists suffer late payments just as much as any other type of freelancer. But it's on top of that, the problem is that you typically can't invoice for your work until after a piece has been published. The knock-on effect of that is just that it makes being able to manage your cash flow really tricky. And you just kind of never know when money is coming in. Just before we started recording this episode, I was actually looking at my kind of finances, and it's a regular problem that you have kind of two columns. You can see what you've billed and the work you've agreed to, but then on the other side is actually what's in your bank account, actually what sort of you've actually been paid, and often there's a really big gap between that.
And issues around payment were a recurring element of every single interview I did for this episode. It's just one of those things that everybody knows is kind of a quirk or a foible of being a freelance journalist. This idea that you have to struggle and you have to really fight to get paid. Often, most of the people I spoke to were owed a couple of £1,000 at any one time that they then had to chase instead of actually doing the meat and potatoes work that got them paid, at least in theory, in the first place. Jenny Stallard is the founder of Freelance Feels, a podcast and blog dedicated to exploring the mental health aspect of being a freelance journalist. She notes that wherever possible, she would always advise people to have a financial buffer before they start freelance journalism.
It's very easy to say, and it's advice everybody gives, and I would say this advice as well, is if you can get some kind of buffer in place before you go freelance, that's the key. For me, I would be very honest, because one of my USPs is trying to be honest. Mine is a big overdraft. When I had a staff job, the bank let me have a nice big overdraft because I had a decent salary, and now I use that as my buffer sometimes if I haven't got anything savings-wise. But if you can at least get what you might consider a month's worth of money in an account, because I really feel that it's not having money so much that's the baseline of having better mental health when you're a freelancer, but it's not worrying about money.
According to a 2017 report by the NCTJ, freelance journalists typically earn around £20,000 a year from journalism, and around one third are believed to be in receipt of state benefits. And as a result of those redundancies and just the realities of freelance financing, not everybody can afford to get into or stay in freelance journalism if they're made redundant. Unfortunately, that then tends to exacerbate some of the issues that we see in journalism as a whole. It's still an elite and rarefied industry characterized by a lack of diversity and an extremely London-centric mindset. And unfortunately, the desirable nature of the industry as a whole means that too often people feel the pressure to work for free. Here's Anna again.
That attitude just filters all the way through, and it's especially acute for freelancers who then get really nervous when they're kind of asking to be compensated. All they're asking for is to be compensated fairly. People who are in a position in their career like where I am, problem with me telling young journalists not to work for free is that then it puts the onus on them to try and change a broken system that they didn't break. I worked for free when I was starting out because that's what I thought you had to do. And I sort of knew that probably wasn't a good thing, but I weighed it up and I thought, well, how else am I going to get clips? So I did it anyway. I think things are different now, though, because if I were to kind of go back, obviously hindsight is 2020, but, I write my own newsletter. And when I first started writing my newsletter a couple of years ago, I did all of that for free. That newsletter serves as part of my portfolio. Not to mention the newsletter actually now brings in some revenue as well. So there are other ways to write for quote unquote for free, but actually that sort of serve you a bit better. Nonetheless, I think it's really important to just think really carefully about whether or not you should accept an opportunity to write for free.
And despite the demonstrable increase in the demand for freelancers, too often freelance rates have not increased. One respondent to the NCTJ survey said that rates had not increased in the 15 years they'd been working. Nicholas Lawson is a freelance journalist and the campaigns manager for Presspad UK, an organisation which aims to diversify the media. Here she explains her own experiences with pay rates.
I think, obviously, the biggest one for me is always the rates. They haven't gone up. So people get paid more each year, usually. They might get a small pay rise, or they may get a large one. But freelance rates just don't go up. The Guardian, for example, I think the rates have been the same for, I don't know how long, but at least 10 years, or if not longer. But obviously that's difficult because cost of living has gone up. And that's why it's impossible, really, to do investigations as a freelancer. I found it really difficult because I did want to try and do some investigations. But just doing, because I do quite a lot of reported features, and you can get the same rate for doing a reported feature as you do for doing just a quick phoner interview kind of thing.
And arguably that reduced impetus for people to dedicate time and resources to doing the investigative journalism pieces that the industry desperately needs has led to another crisis within journalism, where there are fewer people doing the necessary work to hold the powerful to account. Marie LeConte is a freelance journalist, and she's also the author of the book Haven't You Heard? Here she elaborates on that point, but explains why she's actually quite optimistic about rates of pay for freelancers.
I wish that editors and publications recognise the fact that obviously reporting takes a lot longer than opinion, but also, you know, because there's reporting and reporting, so there can be, you know, reporting in that, you know, I'm writing from my desk, but I'm doing 3 phone calls, or reporting that involves actually going to places, you know, even, God forbid, outside London sometimes, and kind of going out to meet people outside, you know, the city you're working in. It basically just has to be a constant balance of you know, basically like some bits of work subsidising other bits of work effectively. So, you know, so I've definitely written quite a lot of stuff that was badly paid for what it was and clearly deserved more. And, you know, my rates would be higher, etc., etc. However, there was things I was very interested in and things that, you know, did quite well in the end because clearly I was interested. So I wrote something that hopefully was quite good and engaging. But then, you know, so writing that and making that bet is A, I think, yeah, good because it's, you know, working on something you find interesting, but B, may well attract actually other editors who may read this, read that and think, okay, well, you know, that's someone I want to commission.
And it is obvious and readily apparent that it's possible to make a good living from freelancing. For those just starting out, however, there is a desperate need for more information about what fair rates are and how to chase down late payments. Here's Anna again.
Because, you know, this is the other problem is that when we operate in silence, we have no idea what is fair and what's not fair. I've had a couple of people who have pointed out to me in the past that I've been really undercharging for things. And I would have never known that had they not said, especially when you're starting out, especially when you're branching out into a new area. So, you know, whereas maybe I know what the going rate is for a feature, I might not know what the going rate is when I get invited to speak on a panel, or when I get asked to do a piece of commercial writing or content marketing or whatever it might be. It's really helpful to be able to have those conversations and to do, you know, effectively to salary share amongst people that you feel comfortable doing so with, or share your rates.
As a result of those money issues, a lot of freelancers take on other roles outside of journalism, whether that's ghostwriting or copywriting. Sean Meads-Williams is the founder of the Freelance Writing Jobs newsletter. She explains that while it's much more acceptable these days for people to have side jobs outside of their main freelancing occupation, she's a little bit unsure that it's necessarily a good thing for the industry.
Yeah, it has, but I think the reasons for that are quite worrying. I'm wary of side gigs. I used to be quite excited by them, but the side hustle is often just a sign that nobody's making enough money. We monetize our hobbies, and we don't do anything just for the joy of it. I make sure that I keep up with ballet classes, all of my hobbies. I try really hard to make sure they're not me in front of a computer screen, and just doing something because it's fun, not because I can sell a story about it, but because I want to give something a go, has drastically changed how I freelance and how much happier I am.
Outside of money management, there are several other skill sets, though, that freelancers need. Unfortunately, the perception is that many J schools and many journalism courses simply do not do enough to prepare people for the likely reality that they will end up as a freelancer at some point in their career. From admin tasks like filing tax returns and chasing down late payments, being aware of your rights, to specific skills like networking and pitching, the perception is that you can only learn some of these skills once you've been pitched into the deep end. And effectively, freelancing is all deep end. Back to Nicola.
You know, I got a lot out of going to City University. I did my MA there. It was paid for by the Scott Trust bursary. I have spoken to people from City and said, you know, I'd love to come back and do a session on freelancing, because a lot of the students you teach will either be freelance in the beginning while they're waiting for applications, and they may as well make the most of it, because some people said they were freelance and they didn't actually do anything. And some people said they're freelance and actually were pitching loads and then they got a job. And then other people will want to go freelance. Loads of my peers on my course have come to me and ask for advice about going freelance after being in positions for a year or two. And yeah, there's the MA didn't really focus on that at all.
Anna too believes that there is a need for more formal education in how to be a freelance journalist.
I think there's a huge need for that. I don't understand why universities and schools don't have a freelancing booth at their careers fairs. I've actually had heated conversations with my undergraduate university, because I've been invited up a number of times to go and talk to current students, and I would love to, except they don't want me to talk in a freelance capacity. They just want to talk, they want me to talk in a journalist capacity, especially because I have worked in-house at national titles and have written for international titles. So that looks all really prestigious. But I don't want to talk about that. I want to talk about the realities of freelancing. And I want to tell those students that there is this thing called self-employment, and actually it may suit some of you. It is hard, but it might be something that people may want to consider, because I had never considered it until quite far into my career.
And undoubtedly there is a need for more information about exactly what the rights of freelancers are. According to the NUJ last year, 9 in 10 freelance journalists missing out on holiday pay could be entitled to it, for instance. Dr. Paul Lashmar is head of the Department of Journalism at City University London. He believes that many of the skills that they teach across the existing journalism modules do prepare people in part for a freelance career.
Perhaps the first thing I should say is that I spent 14 years of my life where I was either full or partly a freelance, so I am very familiar with the problems facing freelancing, as are many of members of my staff who have freelanced for considerable periods of time, and so in some cases continue to do so. Some of our part-time staff, I mean staff members, are freelance, and a lot of our visiting lecturers are also freelancing. So we have you know, a lot of experience between us about freelancing, how you go about it, the problems of it, the strains of living every day, wondering where your income is going to come from. We are aware of that. And indeed, you're right. You know, the announcement this week that BBC is going to lose 450 jobs is a tremendous blow. It makes journalism look like an even more uncertain occupation. But what I see where I am is that the world is changing a number of ways, and freelancing is certainly part of that. So what we seek to do very much is to make sure that people who come to us to be trained as journalists, if they do what we say and they have the capability, that they will leave with a full skill set in the area that they've chosen, whether they're on magazine, newspaper, interactive, financial journalism, and also you know, investigative journalism, broadcast, TV, you know, these all these sectors we cover, and they go out with a complete working kit. You know, they can do it. Plus, of course, these are MA courses, so we need to challenge people at an intellectual level. For instance, I run the ethics course, which is a vital part of journalism. So we challenge our students to develop their critical thinking, as well as their ability to write a good intro or be able to do a piece to camera. So we work on a lot of different levels.
However, given the very real possibility that many of their graduates will either go into or be forced into part or full-time freelancing, Dr. Lashmar does say that they're looking to introduce more freelance-specific modules or courses in the near future.
I took over in August, and I've had a big review of everything we're doing, and I've opened it up to the staff. We're in a discussion at the moment. Now, universities don't move that fast, but we are looking at a number of areas. For instance, we're putting a lot more resources into data journalism, which, whether you're a freelance or staff member, there are a lot of jobs if you're a good data journalism exponent. And you know, so we've just hired a major player in this, and we put a lot of emphasis. We're also looking at, you know, our relation, you know, investigative journalism and its relationship with the NGO sector, because there are a lot of investigative journalists out there now working in places like Greenpeace, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, Global Witness. They've got investigative journalists. So we're thinking, can we work with them to do, you know, to develop, because they use quite a lot of freelancers as well. So we are constantly aware of this, and we know it's a dynamic. But we are reviewing in the course of this year whether we ought to make it more core in actual the courses, or we don't actually have a how to be a freelance module, but we may perceive, you know, we might decide to do that.
The understandable difficulty for journalism courses is that the media landscape changes so rapidly. The business focus of a newspaper one year might not be the business focus the next year, and the skill sets that journalists require are changing all the time. Here's Sean again explaining why she's unsure that a single MA could ever take into account everything that a freelancer needs to know.
Well, I think typically, I mean, I didn't do a journalism MA. My MA was actually in English literature. It was modern contemporary literature at Westminster. So that didn't give me any of the skills I needed. I learned interviewing off the cuff. Most of my experience was in digital. And I remember that the first few pitches I did for magazines was incredibly difficult. The first experience I had of working on magazines was very hard for me. And I think everybody's experience is different. I don't know that there is an MA that will give you every single experience you possibly need, because I feel like our media landscape just changes so quickly now. But I also love that. I love how many journalists I know who didn't go to university, or if they did go to university, they didn't study journalism. And I'm not saying that you don't need an education in journalism. I think there are other ways around it, and it is such a practical vocation that you can learn it. It's something that you can learn through experience rather than having to sit there in a classroom and learn. And I'm always really worried about sitting in the classroom and learning something as practical as journalism. To me, that sounds like sitting in a classroom and learning how to paint. It's, if you're not getting your hands dirty, if you're not trying, then you can't do it.
And the practical aspect of freelance journalism is something that Marie is also very keen to stress.
I would say that to be a good freelancer, it is the same rule as if you want to be a really good journalist, it's just that you have to read a lot. And, you know, and I think being able to know, like, have an idea and kind of instinctively go, actually, you know, I think that fit in at that publication, just comes from reading all those publications, having a really good grasp of basically what place is published. So, and again, you know, hopefully, if you're a journalist, you do have an interest in journalism as well. And, you know, you've got your own patch. And so you're probably quite likely to read stuff in that patch, hopefully, because if not, I'm not really sure what you're doing. So I think it's not necessarily experience as much as just reading and being aware of the market you're kind of operating in.
Regardless of how you get into freelance journalism, the reality is that issues like loneliness and anxiety can hit at any point. One of the things that all our interviewees were keen to stress is that you have to keep a close eye on your work-life balance and its effect on your mental health. Here, Sian takes us through her own experiences.
So you've asked me to stay really, really positive about freelancing. I started freelance writing jobs because I had a really terrible 6 months of freelancing. I think it was the worst I'd ever had. I was in the middle of my MA and I had to postpone my second year for 6 months because I just couldn't scrape together the fees. I was paying for my MA myself. It was thousands of pounds and I could not make that money work. And then obviously by the time I'd started my MA, everything was fine. All of the work started coming in. And yet I was still finding dozens of jobs that I couldn't do anything with anymore. And I was still sending them to friends. And I thought the biggest challenge, I think, when you're job hunting is that soul-destroying thing of checking the same jobs boards over and over again. So you don't just look in the morning, you don't just do it one day, you look three or four times a day because there is nothing else to do. And one of the hardest things as a freelancer is sifting out all of the rubbish.
It's an aspect of freelance life that I think everyone has struggled with at some point or other. The first 6 months that I freelanced were the worst of my life. And I'm still dealing with some of the repercussions of that, sort of financially and in terms of my mental health. And it wasn't until much later that I sought out some help from a GP around some of the anxiety issues that I felt as a result. Here, Jenny explains the realities of mental health for freelancers and the physiological effect that has on the body.
Very much loneliness and isolation, I think. I think there's this sort of glee when you go freelance that you imagine yourself in, you know, cool coffee shops and hotels or a really nice working space, and that is achievable, but it's almost like on day one you expect all of that to be in place and perhaps come to you more than you look for it. I also think, and this is something that came up last night at an event I was at, that someone was talking about the hustle and the marketing side of things and getting yourself out there and sort of pitching for work all the time. And that's very, very challenging because, you know, you can't have a coasting day so much when you freelance, because you've got to always be thinking about, well, what am I doing in June if July I want to go away, for example. So I'd also say getting stressed and overwhelmed with the idea of being everything. A lot of my podcast guests talk about being the every person. So you're everything from the post person to the accountant to the cleaner to the social media person to the marketer to the everything else. That sort of overwhelm of every job is yours as well, I think, is something we perhaps don't expect when we start out of freelancing, because we're so busy thinking about what our freelance is, we don't think about all the other things we're going to have to do for ourselves as well as a business. For freelancers, it can often manifest in how we fuel our bodies. We don't often take time, even though we're at home and we have the whole kitchen at our disposal, we probably just make a can of soup or we forget to have lunch. A lot of freelancers, it's quite a cliche, but a lot of us are tea and coffee monsters. Then come the biscuits, then come the cake. Then all it takes is for you to not have had the best day and suddenly perhaps your exercise intentions go out of the window. And yeah, your physical body isn't sort of able to keep up with the stresses you're going through because it's not being fueled and it's not feeling physically okay enough to carry the mental things that you want it to carry.
In addition to the obvious financial stresses and some of the stresses that come from pitching and being rejected, often the lack of a clear roadmap, an ideal path for freelance careers, can be a real weight. However, Sean doesn't believe that the lack of a prescribed path is necessarily a bad thing.
But I think that ideal path is something that we have been sold throughout our entire lives. So you get a job, you start at the bottom, and you work your way up the rungs of the ladder. And that's the path that we've been given. And one of the best things about freelancing is that that path isn't linear. You can sidestep, you can move. You can go back to something that you didn't think was right for you. You can rework what it is that you thought you were good at, and you can do something else. And I don't think when I started freelancing, anyone could ever imagine that the best projects I did would be in an email. It's a really unusual thing to have. And I think you don't know how the media landscape will look. You don't know how your career will look, you don't know how your life will look, and yet we try and plan for every eventuality. And it's because we've been taught to do it, we've been taught to go from A to B to C all the way through the alphabet, and that's what a career looks like. And that's not the case anymore.
And it's that freedom to concentrate on the work that we really want to do, in spite of all those issues, that makes freelance journalism such a draw for people. Here's Marie.
Basically, I think and you know, and I realise it's easier said than done, but being freelance is actually, you know, like the way you think about it is that obviously it's got quite a lot of drawbacks. So, you know, if I get ill, that's basically on me, and you know, and I'm not going to get paid for however many days, or I can't go on holiday, you know, like I don't have paid holiday days, so I can't go on holiday as much as I used to. So there are quite a lot of like set things, or you know, occasionally it just so happens that there are no news in my patch, so that means I've got nothing to pitch for occasionally weeks at a time, which is a bit of a nightmare. But so when you take all of those negative things, I think it's kind of your duty as a freelancer to remind yourself quite frequently of the reasons why you're doing it and why, you know, like how you can compensate for that. So yeah, so for example, occasionally, obviously I've not done it in a while because it's the winter, but I really enjoy, so when it's sunny, either working from a terrace somewhere, which is the loveliest thing you can do, or even, yeah, occasionally if, let's say, I'm doing... So I think it's normally when things are very, very good or very, very bad. So either if I've done tons of really well-paid work during the month, or it's a case of no one's answering my emails, I have no ideas, I'm quite grumpy, there's nothing going on. You know, just taking the afternoon off, just deciding, you know what, it's just a Tuesday, so I can, and I'm going to have a nice lunch somewhere on a terrace or something, and then I'm going to go for a nice walk. But yeah, maybe go to the cinema at like 3 p.m. on a Tuesday, just because I can. And so I think you do have a duty to yourself to say, actually, I'm losing quite a lot by doing this, so I'm going to make sure I make the best of it as well.
And as a result of the greater emphasis on the role of freelancers within the media industry, people are optimistic that even those trials and tribulations like late payments and having to pitch constantly to people who might not even necessarily understand your skill set might be about to change. Here's Anna.
I think it's already happening. I already feel optimistic. I mean, this is, I've started learning to, as a result of kind of having to do this on a daily basis just as a freelancer, I've started measuring little wins and small milestones. So just the other day I saw that Wired released a really detailed guide to pitching, and that kind of might seem like a sort of a non-event, but to me that signals that Wired are really open to working with freelancers. And they've prioritized it to an extent where they've gone around every single desk and every single desk editor and put together a really detailed guide, because they actually want to work better with their freelancers. From kind of conversations I've had as a result of the campaign, I've realized that a lot of the problems kind of stem from the fact that people who've never freelanced just have no idea what it's like. And just by so many more freelancers being vocal, it has encouraged people who are commissioning them or who are working in-house and who are working with them just to kind of change their own mindset.
And as Sean says, while it's not for everybody, there is a joy to being a freelance journalist, a joy to seeing your work in a variety of publications that is unmatched anywhere else.
I've gone through magazines, agencies, working for e-commerce websites, working for huge companies, working for small companies, having my own company. And I don't think you get that freedom when you are in a staff job, you might well move around, but your career trajectory is often very linear, even if you change roles or change publications. And I've had the opportunity to do some really, really fun things.
Thank you so much to all the interviewees who gave up their time to talk about a subject that matters to them this week. Thank you to Sean, Anna, Jenny, Marie, Paul and Nicola. Media Voices would like to point you to a few of their projects, which we feel are both beneficial and necessary to the health of the journalism industry in the UK. First, please do search out Sean Meads-Williams' book, The Pajama Myth, The Freelance Writer's Survival Guide, on unbound.com/books/The Pajama Myth, as it is perilously close to being funded. Also, don't forget to sign up to Anna Codriorado's newsletter, The Professional Freelancer, and Nicholas Lawson's The Single Supplement newsletter, and more work on behalf of PressPad. Jenny Stallard's Freelance Feels blog and podcast are available at freelancefeels.com. And please do also look out for both Marie Leconte and Paul Lashmar, who are both influential, kind, and have only the best intentions for the journalism industry in the UK. We are keenly aware that we have not even scratched the surface of the realities of being a freelance journalist in 2020. We've come at this with a certain mindset, and I'm sure that there are people from different cultures and different backgrounds who will have completely different experiences. So please, if you have anything to add to this discussion, please do get in touch with us. I'm at chris@voices.media. Thank you very much for listening to this Media Voices Freelance Special. If this is your first time listening to Media Voices, then please do come back next week when me and my two co-hosts, Peter and Esther, will be taking an in-depth look at all the media news that week and featuring an interview with somebody prominent within the industry who will be able to share their views as well. In the meantime, please do go to voices.media to check out our archives and some of the articles we've written and to sign up to our weekly newsletter, which does much of the same. You can also follow us on social by going to @MediaVoicesPod. But until next week, thank you very much for listening and goodbye.